you, gentlemen. The case is submitted, and we'll hear arguments next in Three Affiliated Tribes against Wold Engineering. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. This case raises a unique issue. Does Public Law 280 authorize a state to absolutely bar actions against non-Indians by Indians if they arise on an Indian reservation? This matter is here on certiorari to review a decision of the North Dakota Supreme Court affirming the State District Court's dismissal of petitioner's negligence and breach of contract action against respondent Wold Engineering. The facts of the case are simple. Petitioner, a federally recognized Indian tribe known as the Three Affiliated Tribes, employed Wold Engineering to construct a water supply system on the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation in northwestern North Dakota. The project, known as the Four Bears Water Project, was intended to provide a water supply from Lake Sakakawea to a portion of the reservation population. However, after completion of the project in 1977, defects were discovered in that system that prevented the accomplishment of that objective. Despite attempts at correction by Wold Engineering of the system, petitioner Three Tribes commenced their negligence and breach of contract action in the State District Court for the Northwestern Judicial District of North Dakota. At trial in 1982, Wold moved to dismiss the action on the grounds that federal law prohibited state jurisdiction over the action. The trial court agreed on the grounds that the Three Tribes failed to consent to Public Law 280 civil jurisdiction over the reservation in favor of the state, and on that ground dismissed petitioner's action. On appeal to the Supreme Court of North Dakota, the state Supreme Court affirmed the dismissal, construing a state statute, Chapter 2719, which is included in our appendix to our brief, as evidencing the state legislature's intent to disclaim any jurisdiction over the matter until the Indians consented to Public Law 280 jurisdiction in the civil area. The court noted in the course of its decision, which is in the appendix of the petitioner for cert, that state judicial jurisdiction had extended to these actions against non-Indians by Indians prior to the enactment in 1963 of Chapter 2719. On that basis, the state Supreme Court affirmed the dismissal of the tribe's action against Wold Engineering. Only two sections of Public Law 280 are involved in this matter, Section 6 and Section 7. Under that jurisdictional classification scheme, North Dakota is a so-called optional state and a disclaimer state, meaning that under Section 7, it must take appropriate action to amend its state constitution to remove the federal disclaimer imposed in its admitting act, and secondly, under Section 7 of Public Law 280, it must enact affirmative legislation assuming jurisdiction under Section 7.
Mr. Cross, I take it, since you're appealing from the judgment of the highest court of the state of North Dakota, it's your position that there is some federal constitutional principle or federal statute that which that decision is violated?
That's right, Your Honor. We feel that the state court misconstrued Public Law 280 in holding that it prohibits state court jurisdiction over actions of this sort.
Well, do you think the Supreme Court of North Dakota actually read Public Law 280 to reach that result? I thought its opinion could just as well be construed to mean that the referendum in the early 60s had represented judgment by the people of South Dakota that they didn't want their courts to exercise this kind of jurisdiction.
Your Honor, the Justice Rehnquist, the decision itself indicates plainly that the state court regarded judicial jurisdiction of the state as extending to these actions before the enactment of the state statute involved under the authority of Public Law 280. The sole source of the authority, reading it either as a authorization or as compelling the state legislature to take that action, is the source of that disclaimer. So, taking a look at the state judicial history, under the state constitution and under the course of state judicial declaration, the state had judicial jurisdiction over these actions prior to that enactment. That enactment was explicitly taken under Section 7 of Public Law 280, and that, consequently, concerns a question of federal interpretation.
But up to then, it's all questions of state law, isn't it?
That's correct, Justice Rehnquist.
This case is a curious one, isn't it? Because here the tribe is asserting jurisdiction in the state court, and usually these cases come up here in just the reverse posture.
That's correct, Justice Blackmun. It is a surprising case in the sense that the Indian people here are asserting the rights as citizens, the rights that they have in common with other members of the state to sue in state court. So the constitutional question that's at stake is that assume that Public Law 280 was lifted out of this context and that this action was taken solely as a matter of state law, would that violate equal protection and due process rights of the Indian people involved?
Was your due process argument argued below?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
Well, Mr. Cross, I suppose that it wouldn't be necessary to reach that if, in fact, we thought that Public Law 280 was the grounds on which the North Dakota court based its holding, and we could, I suppose, give North Dakota another look at it.
That's correct, Justice O'Connor. Our position is this, is that the state statute is based on a misconstruction or on a construction of Public Law 280, and that raises a federal law question that is appropriate for resolution by this court.
Let me ask you another question. If a state court had jurisdiction over the tribe's cause of action here, what about Wohl's counterclaim? Would the court have jurisdiction over that as well?
Since the plaintiff here is a tribe, the tribe, according to decisions by this court, has a sovereign immunity. It may be provided for in contracts that that can be waived. Of course,
you think
to the
there
extent
would be
of a
waiver
set-off.
As a matter of law if the tribe decides to sue in the state court?
Well, as a matter of law, Justice O'Connor, the Wold Engineering can recover to the extent of a set-off. They claim a small amount of money is due them under the contract, some $4,500. That would be available to them as a set-off against the tribe's claim. The question of an affirmative counterclaim or claims that might arise present a tougher question.
Well, the set-off, you have to adjudicate their claim.
That's correct.
Concede that much could be done. On what theory? It's a waiver.
That's correct.
Of sovereign immunity.
Your Honor, to that limited extent.
Is there any jurisdictional problem of a state court asserting jurisdiction against an Indian tribe over a claim arising on the reservation?
Your Honor, based on the state court decision below, they did not differentiate between claims by tribal members or claims by tribes. Based on their reading, both of the state law and of Public Law 280, they did not make a distinction in that regard. If there were a distinction to be made, I think that would have to be made by the court below on remand. But here in the decision, they made no distinction between the rights of a tribe to sue in state court, nor am I certain they could, but in fact they did not. The state court decision below established a simple proposition. Either Indian tribes consent to Public Law 280 civil jurisdiction, or they're barred from suing non-Indians in state court. Public Law 280 has been enacted for over 30 years now, and the decisions by this court make clear that there is no legal or factual connection between suits against non-Indians and Public Law 280. It's possible to give quite a full account of what the meaning both of the plain terms and the legislative history of Public Law 280 is in the light of recent decisions by this court, most notably Kennerlevy District Court, Washington v. Yakima Indian Nation, and Bryan v. Itasca County.
Mr. Cross, am I correct, under the decision of the North Dakota Supreme Court, your people have no forum whatsoever?
That's correct, Your Honor. Now, in the course of those decisions that I mentioned, this court has construed the application of Public Law 280 in a variety of contexts. In cases of non-PL 280 states in McClanahan v. Arizona State Tax Commission, in cases where the states assumed full PL 280 jurisdiction in Bryan v. Itasca County, and in cases where the state has assumed partial jurisdiction in Washington v. Yakima Indian Nation. In each of those cases, this court has construed the plain terms and the legislative intent of Public Law 280 as being remedial in nature. And by this I mean that Congress intended to correct problems on the reservation, both in the criminal and in the civil jurisdictions. And in Bryan v. Itasca County, this court provided that the state, if they assume civil jurisdiction, may adjudicate cases between Indians, even as between Indians, and may apply their state law to govern those actions. Consequently, in this court's decisions construing Public Law 280, there is no indication that pre-existing rights of Indians were terminated. And this court, in a course of decision over the last 100 or more years, has indicated that Indians have the right to seek the aid of state courts and state statutes in protecting their property against intrusion by non-Indians. Justice Lamar in Chilt v. Trapp at 224 U.S. 665 said that Indians' rights, their private rights, are enforced to the same extent and in the same way as other residents or citizens of the United States. That decision came in the context of Indians enforcing their federal tax exemption in state court. The power that the Indian people have to sue in state court to protect their property rights has been exercised on a number of occasions. First, in a decision in 1857, Fellows v. Blacksmith, 19 Howard, this court affirmed a state court order ejecting non-Indians from tribal lands. This court likewise indicated that the states may seek the aid of state statutes.
But
in New York,
those were cases, weren't they, where the state court had affirmatively said we have jurisdiction, we want jurisdiction, and this court upheld that exercise of jurisdiction. Here you have a different situation where I don't see those are necessarily relevant. Because here the state court says our law provides that in the absence of consent by the Indians under the 68 revisions of the Public Law 280, we're not to exercise jurisdiction.
That's correct, Justice Rehnquist. However, that decision turns on an interpretation of Public Law 280. The decision below clearly states that the court feels that they were, that the state legislature was disclaiming jurisdiction under Public Law 280. Consequently, the question arises, does Public Law 280, not state law, authorize a bar against these sorts of actions? And I think it's clear that in the construction of Public Law 280, this court has said that state legislations enacted under that authority cannot be construed as a termination or abrogation of pre-existing rights. In Bryan v. Itasca County, this court held that civil jurisdiction granted under that statute was for a very limited purpose, and it was not intended to indicate that the state had broader authority beyond the terms of that act to tax Indian property. Consequently, if there was a negative reading of Public Law 280 so that the state felt compelled to disclaim jurisdiction outside of Public Law 280, that's a matter of federal law and federal construction of a statute.
What you want is to have the North Dakota Supreme Court take another look at the situation, disabused of any misapprehension about 280.
That's correct, Justice. In the context of the situation where the state assumes no Public Law 280 jurisdiction, this court has still recognized that Indians have access to state courts for actions arising on reservation. In McClanahan v. Arizona State Tax Commission, this court, in deciding the issue of whether the state of Arizona may tax Indian income, said that Indians have access to state courts to sue non-Indians, citing the case of Felix v. Patrick, which is cited in our briefs. Secondly, in that same case, this court indicated that the states have a recognized interest in regulating non-Indian conduct, citing Surplus Trading Co. v. Cook. Consequently, it's clear that the pre-existing jurisdictional rules and relationships outside of the plain terms of the Act and what the intent of the Act was were not disturbed. In other words, if the Indians were recognized as having access under state law to state court, and if the state took the position they had the authority to regulate non-Indian conduct on reservation, as North Dakota did before the enactment of Chapter 2719 under PL 280, it would seem that that jurisdictional relationship wasn't disturbed.
Mr. Cross, may I ask a question? Because when one reads this, the North Dakota Supreme Court's opinion, one might get the impression, at least I got it the first time I read it, that they were just construing their own law, and they did not feel compelled to construe it the way they did by Public Law 280. Can I ask if in the briefs and argument before that court, did your opponent argue that Public Law 280 required them to deny jurisdiction, or did he rely on North Dakota law?
As I read the appellate record in the North Dakota Supreme Court, the position taken by respondent was that Public Law 280 authorized the state to enact Chapter 2719 and disclaim jurisdiction that it previously claimed, or in the alternative that Public Law 280 was in nature of a preemptive statute, which by a negative reading.
Well, the latter, that reading would be consistent with yours, but the former reading, if it just merely authorized them, they just thought it authorized them to do it, I suppose they could have claimed they had the authority even without Public Law 280.
That would raise a different issue. That issue would be raised in the context of a state policy barring Indians. The legal history of North Dakota that's reviewed in our brief indicates in repeated declarations of the Supreme Court that Indians, along with other state citizens, are entitled to sue in state court.
Well, that was all before 1963.
That was before 1963.
And then say that because of the 1963 enactment of 2719, which was a North Dakota statute, everything's changed.
Our expectation is that when this issue is clarified by the Supreme Court on the construction of the Public Law 280 or the federal law issue, that the prior declarations that as a matter of state constitutional laws and federal constitutional rights, that the Indians do have access to state courts for actions arising on reservations is the proper policy they would follow. a recent decision by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals entitled Poitras v. Damaris indicates that's how the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals viewed the repeated declarations of the state Supreme Court. In that context, they were called on to decide whether a substantial state policy would be infringed if diversity jurisdiction was allowed in an Indian case that arose on reservation. They found that the declarations of the state Supreme Court indicated no such policy.
I'm just wondering if one possible thing we should consider is perhaps sending the case back to that court and asking them the basis of their decision. Because if it's one basis, then it presents a federal constitutional question. If it's another basis, it presents a statutory question. Because I don't think it's as clear as you tell us, to be honest with you.
That's correct, Justice. That would be one option to clarify the underlying basis of decision. I do feel that based on the prior decisions of the state Supreme Court, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals decision in Poitras, that it is quite clear that the sole basis for decision was federal law. I do admit that there could be some ambiguity, but I don't see it either in the record or in the state court's decision below.
Mr. Cross, how about the statement at page 7A of the petition, which is part of the opinion of the Supreme Court of North Dakota, where they say that Henry Whiteshield, they're quoting from, and they say, the people and the legislature of the state have taken affirmative action which amounts to a complete disclaimer of jurisdiction over civil causes of action which arise on an Indian reservation, except upon acceptance by the Indian citizens of the reservation the manner provided by the legislative enactment. They're not saying this is how we decide, judicially decide something. They're saying this is what the legislature meant. Are you saying that the legislature enacted the law under a misapprehension of what Public Law 280 meant?
Justice Rehnquist, that action was taken under Section 7 of Public Law 280, and the action that was taken by the state legislature and embodied in the state statute was construed by the Supreme Court as being affirmatively authorized legislation under Section 7 of Public Law 280. The question then becomes, as a matter of federal law, is that the sort of legislation that was contemplated by Public Law 280 and the Congress that enacted it? I don't see any indication that there's an independent policy or basis for that decision.
Well, do you think anything we'd say about Public Law 280 would make the Supreme Court of North Dakota feel differently about what the legislature meant by enacting a statute?
I think that if the legislature and the construction of the statute by the state Supreme Court is conflict with Public Law 280, that they would take what this court has to say very seriously indeed.
You're saying it would take a new act of the legislature, not just a new decision of the Supreme Court of North Dakota?
No, I'm saying, Justice Rehnquist, that the statute, as construed by this court, since it is under the authority of a federal law and a function of a delegated power, would take on a new aspect to that court. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
You're also relying on decisions of the North Dakota court subsequent to Whiteshield or whatever it is,
aren't you?
So far
correct.
As 280 is concerned.
That's correct. There were decisions subsequent to that statute and that decision that indicated that Indians do have access to state courts for certain purposes. That is a case of White Eagle v. Dorgan, a tax case involving the authority of the state to tax certain income on reservation. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Mr. Claiborne.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Perhaps most usefully could begin by addressing Justice Stevens's concern, that is the exact basis on which, to the extent that we can discern it from its opinion, the North Dakota Supreme Court rested its judgment. I draw the Court's attention to the end of that opinion, which appears at page 10A of the petition appendix. The Court is here addressing and very conscious of the constitutional problem, both under the state constitution and under the federal constitution, that would arise if the state courts were closed to Indians in this discriminatory way, absent special authorization by the Congress for that closure. And the court concludes its opinion by saying, after discussing this constitutional problem and saying that it does not stand as an impediment to their result, quoting from this court's opinion in the Yakima case, and then in the words of the North Dakota court, likewise, the people of North Dakota and the legislature were acting under explicit authority granted by Congress in the exercise of its federal power over Indians when our Constitution was amended and Chapter 2719 of the North Dakota Code was enacted. We therefore find no equal protection violation of the Constitution of either the state or the United States, and for the reasons stated, we affirm the judgment of the district court. It seems to us plain that the North Dakota Supreme Court was resting its judgment that no constitutional violation, either of its own or of the federal constitution, was involved, only because they construed Public Law 280 as having authorized, not as Public Law 280 does authorize, an assumption of new jurisdiction, but a disclaimer, a repudiation of pre-existing jurisdiction. If the North Dakota Supreme Court were disabused of that misreading of Public Law 280, every indication is that that court would then find that there was no justification under either its own constitution or under the federal constitution for uniquely closing the courts of the state to Indian plaintiffs, whether the tribe or individual members. And for that reason, we suggest that the appropriate disposition is to remand the case to the North Dakota Supreme Court with a construction of Public Law 280, which we have argued.
Well, Mr. Claiborne, wouldn't our normal practice be, if we agreed with you, that the Supreme Court of North Dakota was wrong in saying that Section 280 had affirmatively authorized this, to go on and decide for ourselves whether we thought there was a constitutional violation resulting from the decision of the Supreme Court of North Dakota? I mean, we don't ordinarily remand in a situation like that, I don't believe.
Justice Rehnquist, we do not oppose the suggestion that if the federal constitutional question is as plain as we think it is, it would be appropriate for this court to go ahead and decide it, and accordingly to reverse the judgment without the need for any further proceedings except the trial of the contract claim in the District Court of North Dakota. Our suggestion is simply that as a matter of deference to the state court, this court might think it more appropriate to afford the highest court of the state an opportunity to correct its own error without the misapprehension which led it into that error, rather than a simple reversal. But it is really not for us, as a mere amicus in the case, to be suggesting in any strong way what the appropriate disposition is. We ourselves have no doubt that in the absence of any federal authorization for discriminating against Indian plaintiffs, the federal constitution would require North Dakota to admit them to its courts. We likewise assume, from what the North Dakota Supreme Court itself has said, that the state constitution would require that result. And if there is a state constitutional ground, it might be appropriate to afford that court an opportunity to invoke it.
How about Section 1981? Do you think that's applicable if this court goes ahead and tries to solve the problem?
It does seem to us that Section 1981 may well be applicable. However, it is fair to say that, as far as I'm aware, that ground was not argued below, and accordingly it might be particularly inappropriate for this court to reach that question. We simply mention it as one more indication of the problem that is created by this misreading of Public Law 280. As to that, it seems to us quite clear that Public Law 280 was intended in its own words under Section 6 to remove impediments to the assumption of jurisdiction, not to erect new impediments, no license was given for that, and to the assumption of jurisdiction, not to the disclaimer of jurisdiction. And likewise, Section 7 is clear in that it gives federal permission to states not having jurisdiction over certain categories of claims involving Indians to assume jurisdiction, not to repudiate previously existing jurisdiction. I may say that the North Dakota amendment to its constitution itself suggests no direction to the legislature of the state to repudiate any previously existing jurisdiction. On the contrary, all that happened in 1958 is that the people of that state, in response to Public Law 280, and with in a way that on its face seems unobjectionable, said, we retain our disclaimer of jurisdiction over Indian lands, provided, however, that the legislature may accept such jurisdiction as is delegated by act of Congress. That in no way to us suggests any repudiation of pre-existing jurisdiction. And indeed, the 1963 Act of the State Legislature speaks of jurisdiction being extended to cases involving Indians. Nothing about disclaiming or repudiating older jurisdiction. Because those statutes and the constitutional amendments read in that way, it is and must be inviting to the Supreme Court of North Dakota to reconstrue those statutes, which are perfectly able to be read as consistent with Public Law 280 in that way, once this court has indicated that Public Law 280 did not authorize any repudiation of old jurisdiction. Of course, it's possible to argue that notwithstanding Public Law 280, the states might be free to disclaim, quite independently of any federal authorization, jurisdiction over Indians. But the decisions of this court make it clear that there is no federal obstacle to the assumption of jurisdiction over a claim by an Indian against non-Indians within the state, at least in the absence of any tribal court which has asserted that jurisdiction, and certainly not when the tribe itself is the plaintiff. There can be no arguable infringement of tribal self-government when the tribe is the plaintiff, as is here. The irony of this case is that the claim of tribal self-government and infringement is made by the non-Indian defendant, not by the tribe itself. It's a case where the defendant is being more Roman than the Romans. The pre-existing law before Public Law 280 in this court and in the state courts was quite clear that states could assume jurisdiction over this sort of claim by an Indian. In the absence of any federal impediment to the assumption of that jurisdiction, we, as we've suggested, see a serious equal protection constitutional obstacle to declining to exercise.
Mr. McCutcheon.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. May I take a moment to restate the question which I thought was today before this court. In petitioner's petition for a writ of certiorari, the question presented was, did the state trial court have jurisdiction to hear and decide a cause of action brought by a federally recognized Indian tribe against a non-Indian defendant regarding a matter arising within the exterior boundaries of the Indian reservation?
You do not quite state the question the same way in your brief, do you?
I'm trying to point the distinction, Your Honor.
Well, which question do you think is before the court? I think
our question and this question are fairly close and are before the court. But what has happened is that I think that this question has galloped around in the various briefs. And possibly I should not do it. I thought I would try and bring it back to the question as it existed on the application for writ of certiorari by showing the distinction, but it's easy to find the distinction if the court will simply recognize that in the government's brief on the certiorari application, they stated the question. There are some extraneous words in it that should be stricken, but when that is done, it comes basically back to the petitioner's question. And in our brief, on the same point, the certiorari, the question there then comes very close to what I have outlined. Then it begins to deviate. And in the petitioner's brief on the merits, the questions presented, which presumptively to me mean the issues, there are now three different questions set out. Number one is not in this proceeding at all, in my judgment. Number two should be carved of extraneous language to bring it somewhat within the question upon which we think the writ of certiorari was granted. And number three should be also reworked because we now get into equal protection and due process clauses. And let me say this, that those clauses were argued in the North Dakota Supreme Court. And the North Dakota Supreme Court did reach those issues. And then that issue, however, was not an issue in the case. So we do feel that the question should be restated. And finally, in connection with the final brief served upon us, which is the petitioner's reply brief, we do not agree with the statement made in the first sentence that we are in agreement with the petitioners that there's only a sole issue.
Mr. McCutcheon?
Yes, sir.
You feel then that, well, the question presented for review in the petition, the one-sentence thing, does not include the equal protection argument that they now advance in their brief.
Your Honor, that is correct. However, in all fairness, it was raised in the North Dakota Supreme Court. The North Dakota Supreme Court did go to it.
Well, there are two requirements for us to consider something. One is that it be passed upon by the court below, and the other that it be presented in the petition for certiorari or fairly subsumed by the court.
Yes. But it was reached by the court below. But I believe that there has been extraneous or extra material now brought into this argument. Let us turn for a moment to some of the argument advanced by both counsel for the petitioner and counsel for the government. The argument seems to be made that the North Dakota Supreme Court was incorrect in its conclusion, and specifically that the North Dakota Supreme Court should have recognized that it had prior jurisdiction. What counsel for the petitioners is arguing today is that 280 did not bar a prior exercise jurisdiction by a court. But that presumes something. This court has stated many times in these cases that the jurisdiction must be conferred by an act of Congress. Now, until 280, which this court has said in several recent cases, I believe you said it just a couple of months ago in the New Mexico versus Mescalero Apache case, that 280 was the first, not the second, but was the first grant of power of general applicability with respect to this type of a matter. Now, if you said it, it must be so. You have said it in other cases, and we certainly accept that, and why? For one reason. We do not find that North Dakota has ever been given, outside of an Indian Act in the middle 40s, and any grant of power by the Congress of the United States for our courts to assume jurisdiction. So it is not a question of the old jurisdiction, because if they didn't have jurisdiction because it was not conferred upon them, then there would be no prior jurisdiction that could spring back into existence, or if not springing back into existence, would have remained in existence. It was never there in the first instance.
Well, North Dakota certainly thought it was, didn't it?
Yes, but North Dakota was wrong. And North Dakota, the Supreme Court of North Dakota, was wrong, and they were wrong under the test in Williams versus Lee. Now, let's, if we may, go to North Dakota. A few moments ago, the matter of the White Shield case was raised. I'm sorry, let's go a step of that. Or let me change my argument just a moment. Public Law 280, 1953. 5 years later, 1958, North Dakota, through its people, amended its constitution pursuant to the authority granted by 280. That is the legislative history. 5 years after that, in 1963, North Dakota adopted the legislation through its legislature to further implement the matters, and that is now found as 27-19 of the North Dakota Century Code. 5 years after that, Congress enacted the Indian Civil Rights Act, 1953, 1958, 1963, 1968. Now, what North Dakota did, because the Indians asked for it, when North Dakota in 1963 adopted Chapter 27-19 of the Century Code, they did what? They put in a consent clause. They said this jurisdiction which we are imposing at this time becomes effective when? Upon consent by the Indians through an election. We preceded the Indian Civil Rights Act in that respect by 5 years. Now, go to the North Dakota cases. In 1957, there was the case of Vermilion versus Spotted Elk. And our court there held that it had jurisdiction. In that, our court was in error. Our court, however, subsequently in In Re White Shield, said, in effect, we were wrong in that case. And In Re White Shield, our court said this. And In Re White Shield is in 1963. Here's what our court said. However, by the amendment of Section 203 of the North Dakota Constitution and the passage of Chapter 244 of the Session Laws of 1963, which is now 27-19 of the Century Code, the people and the legislature have taken affirmative action which amounts to a complete disclaimer of jurisdiction over civil causes of action which arise on an Indian reservation, except upon acceptance by the Indian citizens of the reservation in the manner provided by the legislative enactment. Then the constitutional amendment is set forth. Following In Re White Shield.
You agree with the answer given to my question to your opposing counsel that this leaves these Indians without a forum in this case?
Yes, sir, I do. But I do not believe that that is discriminatory in any manner, because it is my belief from the cases that I have read of this court, where this court says that is not racial discrimination, and this court goes so far in one case, I don't recall the name of the case right at the moment, as to answer that precise question, and it says there will be times when there will not be a forum. This court has said that. But they said that is not an invidious discrimination. That is simply because of the situation, the circumstances surrounding this particular type of legislation with these particular people who occupy a different status from anyone else. And furthermore, this court
has... That's a good way to get rid of a lawsuit, isn't it?
I'm sorry, sir?
It's a good way to get rid of a lawsuit, isn't it?
Sir, jurisdiction can always be accepted. We have all stood ready since 1958 to have jurisdiction of our courts fully extended over the reservations. The keys to the courthouse are in the hands of the Indians, at least in North Dakota. They're right there. All they must do is have an election. Now, our statute does have certain provisions on election. Those provisions are probably, possibly invalid. It's not an issue in this lawsuit, because I think now Congress has said how the election shall be conducted, called, and so forth. So probably to that extent, those election provisions of our statute would fall as procedural, but the point remains the power and authority is there. Now.
Any other group of people in North Dakota?
No, sir. 280.
Only Indians?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Then in Gorneau, which was a subsequent 1973 case, the North Dakota Supreme Court expressly stated they had overruled In Re White Shield. The arguments have been probably quite well covered, but we must remember that 280, Public Law 280 itself, is not an act that bars jurisdiction.
Mr. McCutcheon, you said a moment ago that in Gorneau, the Supreme Court of North Dakota stated that it had overruled White Shield. Is that what you meant?
I'm sorry. No, sir. I did make a mistake. Spotted Owl. I'm sorry. We conclude that Vermilion, which is Vermilion versus Spotted Elk, no longer states the rule to be applied in determining whether state courts have jurisdiction. Now, this court has indicated, as a matter of fact, that the preemption doctrine applies. This court has also stated, and it was well stated in New Mexico versus Mescalero Apaches, that the preemption doctrine is not quite the same as the normal preemption doctrine. Sorry. The normal preemption doctrine would simply be that something is supreme and there would be no alternative. This court has extended that because it has said that there are exceptions, and certain of those exceptions, for example, are tax cases. There are exceptional circumstances where the courts may have some jurisdiction. And it was interesting to note that Petitioner's Counsel referred to the case of something versus Dorgan. True. North Dakota case, decided in 1973. It's a tax case, but in that case, our court said, and the facts were stipulated, incidentally, our court said that our courts have no jurisdiction over civil causes of action with respect to the Indian reservations. Our court is now very, very consistent. This court has not too long ago, in one of the cases, stated that Rice versus Rayner, that tribal sovereignty itself exists at the sufferance or pleasure of the Congress of the United States. This court has also stated the present policy of Congress, which is to try to bring the Indians, and this is the policy of 280, to try to bring the Indians into the full mainstream of our society. That is one of the purposes of 280, as I understand it. And certainly, the states do appear to be working for that. The mandatory states under 280 were what? Granted instant jurisdiction. The disclaimer states were required to remove an impediment to the assumption of that jurisdiction. But again, assumption in that sense means exactly what the Act seems to say. It is the assumption of any jurisdiction. In North Dakota, it would be the assumption of jurisdiction in the first instance. There were acts, for example, in Minnesota, which I understand did grant certain jurisdictions, certain congressional acts, but none in North Dakota. And in reviewing all of these cases, it is necessary to draw the distinctions with respect to certain state situations. For example, Candelaria, 1926 case, is advanced in the brief of petitioners and the government. But go back to 1919 and look at the case of Pueblo Santa Rosa, which is mentioned in Candelaria, and it tells you from whence came the power of those courts, the power of those states' courts. Those state courts came from treaties with Mexico and Spain. And they were carried forward into the law, and they were carried forward into the state law by act of Congress, by requirement of Congress. The same is true, for example, with some of these states, for example, in the area of Oklahoma, Arkansas, and so forth. North Dakota had a territorial government. Oklahoma, some of those states, did not have an organized territorial government. There were certain laws in the unorganized territory that were created by Congress, certain courts that were created by Congress. And in statehood that followed, those were required to be carried forward into the state laws. We have varying situations, but in North Dakota, there has never been a prior grant, a specific prior grant of authority from the Congress of the United States which wields the authority in these instances for a special people who have a different relationship than others. The test has always been, as stated in Williams versus Lee, whether there is any infringement upon the basic rights. North Dakota has met all requirements set forth by 280. We took those step by step. We did it by a vote of the people. We amended our Constitution. We acted by our legislature, and we have taken the procedural steps required by Public Law 280. In Yakima, Washington versus Yakima, the matter there was Washington having taken or having set full jurisdiction over 8 subject matter areas, and the attack there was made that couldn't do it. You had to take either all or none, and this court said, no, you have the power to take the whole, you may take the lesser, and that does make logic. There have been challenges to 280, but 280 has withstood those challenges. It now requires that which we took 5 years before 1968, the consent of the Indians. The doctrine of conceptual clarity, which existed in the days of, 150 years ago in the Winchester versus Georgia case, where it simply said that there was no jurisdiction there except that which was granted by Congress, and it was totally exclusive, the state might not enter. That has been modified. There are some exceptions now to that particular doctrine, and that is rather stated carefully in New Mexico versus Mescalero Apaches. And it basically comes back to 3 areas that Indian tribes have been implicitly divested of their sovereignty in certain respects by virtue of their dependent status. That under certain circumstances, a state may validly assert authority over the activities of non-members on a reservation. That in exceptional circumstances, a state may assume
dependent status.
Yes.
How do you ever expect them to get independent status if they're free to be robbed?
Sir, I do not believe they are free to be robbed. I believe that they must be encouraged to seek the independent status, and I think that is the thrust of 280. At least that appears to be the congressional intent, for them to seek to become or provide an opportunity to become full-fledged members in the society. Perhaps the thrust of Congress is that they are not dependent members.
I hope you don't think my silence means I agree.
Sir, I'm used to having judges disagree with me. I didn't feel that you were disagreeing, Your Honor. Oh, yes, one thing further with respect to this counterclaim. The argument advanced in the Supreme Court by counsel for the petitioner was, in response to sharp questions by our court with respect to the counterclaim, was that, well, that could be treated as an offset against the judgment that we're going to get. Well, now, wait a minute. I seem to have remembered in all the years that I've been in and out of the courtrooms that someplace in some book somewhere I read where a plaintiff did not recover on his suit and the defendant did recover on the counterclaim. The counterclaim in this instance is a meritorious claim. It is not subject to the doctrine of set-off. I'm sorry?
Why not?
Because it's not yet established that the plaintiff can recover a judgment. In summation, I would point out only that 280 is an act conferring jurisdiction in the first instance, original authority for jurisdiction to be exercised by the states, that North Dakota has properly followed all steps that are strictly required of our state in so doing, that we have placed all of the machinery in existence, subject only to the consent of the Indians, that the judgment of the North Dakota Supreme Court should be affirmed.
The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments.